Hello and welcome to Beyond Approach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
Tux Lerzel.
We be drinking and we be swearing. We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out here doing its thing, and we like to acknowledge that. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
It sure is.
Yeah, we're doing it.
So today, we are drinking, it is called a whiskey sling. Mm. There is some sort of speculation on where the name comes from, and a lot of people say that it's because you would sling it back.
Didn't we have a sling of some sort before?
I don't think we've had a sling before. We've had lots of cocktails, but we've had a
flip. Oh, I'm thinking of a flip or a slip. Yeah, flip.
A flip. Flip, yeah. We have definitely mentioned this before in the past on this show, but back in the day, Americans drank a whole fucking lot. We were drinking all the goddamn time. It is truly baffling how much Americans were drinking every day before Prohibition. And if you think that Prohibition was not successful, you would be wrong. Along with the abolitionist movement and Prohibition together, they basically changed America's relationship with alcohol completely. People drank way, way less after Prohibition, even though the Volstead Act was eventually repealed. The abolitionist movement really did get people to sort of reevaluate how much they were drinking, how often they were drinking. It's a different world when you think about, like, people were drinking something like 8 gallons of hard liquor a year, like, whoa, in like the 1700s and 1800s. There's like a sort of a peaks and valleys into, like, people tended to drink more in times of depression or war, that kind of thing. And that has continued since Prohibition. There's a lot to talk about here with this, and I do actually plan to do a mini-sode about this kind of topic because there's too much to get into just now when I'm just trying to talk about this one cocktail. But just keep in mind that just because Prohibition didn't happen until the early 20th century doesn't mean people weren't worried about how much we were drinking until Prohibition. That just wasn't the case. In fact, in 1785, a man named Benjamin Rush, who actually signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote something called An Inquiry into the Effects of Spirituous Liquors Upon the Human Body. He wasn't advocating for complete, like, abstinence from alcohol or teetotaling at all. He was just sort of suggesting that we needed to cut back and drink weaker spirits less often. I don't know if it was a pamphlet or a book or whatever, but in it he wrote this sort of hyperbolic story about a friend of his, an acquaintance that he knew, who
I'm right here, Tux.
Yeah.
Okay. This is rude.
Yes. He liked to drink toddies all the time. He said he was perpetually drinking toddies. But the more he drank, he eventually graduated from toddies to grog. Grog is essentially rum mixed with water.
Okay.
But then he graduated from grogs to slings, and from slings to raw rum, or straight rum.
Again, I'm right here.
And then he died.
Oh, shit. Okay. Okay.
You're not dead yet.
It was... Thank you for saying the yet. I'm just dead inside.
Yes. So as I mentioned in our last episode 2 weeks ago, in the 1700s, we weren't really drinking very many mixed drinks, but we were cutting a lot of our spirits with water. You have something to say?
Okay. He died of, like, something alcohol-related?
It just says, like,
okay,
he went from toddies to grog, from grog to slings, from slings to raw rum, and then he died.
See? Okay.
Yeah.
I need more details about this.
I imagine, yeah, probably cirrhosis.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know.
But so, in the 1700s...
I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about... Arrested Development, and, like, this is why you don't. Yes.
That's why you always leave a note.
Yes.
That's why you don't graduate from grog to
slings. Yes, exactly. This seems extreme, but okay. Go on, I'm sorry.
So as I mentioned in our last episode 2 weeks ago, in the 1700s, we weren't really drinking very many mixed drinks, but we were cutting a lot of our spirits with water. So toddies, grogs, and slings are all forms of spirit mixed with water. And back at this point in sort of cocktail history, mixed drinks were not spirit specific. Essentially, you could make a toddy or a sling with whatever you wanted. It could be gin, it could be whiskey, it could be applejack, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was all just sort of about ratios. So the only real difference between a toddy and a sling was the strength. Essentially, a sling is stronger than a toddy because it has a bit less water added to it.
Oh, okay.
Unlike toddies, though, which are always served warm, slings can be served cold or warm. Both of them have sugar added to them, and both of them, well, if a sling is served warm, both of them would have grated nutmeg on top. Also, like toddies, slings at this point in the 1700s were one of the most popular, I'm going to say cocktails in quotes, it was a mixed drink, most popular drinks in America, and they were for a very, very long time. The word sling appeared in print many, many, many times over the years. In fact, the word cocktail, when the word cocktail first appeared in print in a newspaper in Hudson, New York in 1806, it was described as a bittered sling, meaning that along with the water, the sugar, and the spirits, bitters were added, either for flavor purposes or medicinal purposes, because bitters were often used as like a stomach-settling sort of medicine. Gin was probably the most popular liquor used to make a sling. But as I said, they weren't spirit specific. You could make a whiskey sling, and we today are drinking a rye whiskey sling because my story is all about American whiskey.
I love it.
So let's take a taste, raise a glass.
Cheers.
Cheers.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It's good. It's a little sort of boring. It's just whiskey with a little bit of sugar and water.
Yeah.
Mixed drinks were so rudimentary at this point. That's what people would have been drinking. It's just adding a little water to their spirits. And the sugar is supposed to make it a little bit more palatable so you can sling it back.
Ah, yes.
So 2 weeks ago, Stephanie stole a story.
I did.
Stephanie told a story about GW, George Washington. Today, I am going to continue that theme for the month of September. And I will also be talking about G-dubs.
W.
Ah.
The legacy.
The legacy.
OGW.
Oh, literally OGW.
OGW is the name.
Yes. So from the very beginning of George
OGW.
Washington.
Oh,
who's that?
I don't know that girl.
From the very beginning of OGW's first term as president, almost everyone in the country loved him. There were no political parties yet, and everyone was just trying to get along and work together for the good of the country. And that's how old Georgie wanted things to stay. He hated the idea of political parties. But by the time his 8 years in office were up, George Washington was one of the most divisive figures in the country. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this, way too many for us to get into today, but one event in particular epitomized how and why his reputation changed so dramatically over those 8 years. And that event is called the Whiskey Rebellion. So what had happened was, in the 1790s, the government decided to put a tax on distilled spirits.
Boo!
Yes, and much like Stephanie, thousands of rural farmers said, no ma'am. They said, boo.
Wait, will my money go to libraries?
Nope. These farmers rose up and they refused to pay the tax and eventually led to an open revolt against the government. And this is when George Washington decided it was time to swoop in with the army and crack some skulls to show these peasants who's boss.
Ooh, wow.
Good man.
Strong move. Strong opener.
Yes. So I would like to propose a toast to the First Amendment. And our rights to freedom of speech and assembly and petition.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The First Amendment isn't what a lot of people on the internet think it is, but I'm looking forward to this.
It does not protect our rights to scream fire in a crowded theater.
No, or just be racist without any consequences. Like, the government is not coming after you. It is the mob of people that are angry.
Literally, yes.
And that is their right to come after you.
Yeah, but it does protect our right to tell the government to go fuck themselves if they're doing something we don't
Absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely, yeah.
This whole thing basically started because the country was in so much debt after the American Revolution. Initially, individual states were on the line to pay off their debts to the rich investors who had bankrolled us through the Revolutionary War. But when the Constitution was ratified in 1788, the federal government agreed to take on those debts instead. And it all added up to, well, some estimates say as high as $79 million in 1790s money, which is almost $2.5 billion today, at a time when we were not comfortable with debt in the way we are now.
Yeah.
$2.5 billion is a lot of fucking money at a time when we're like, wait a minute, we have to pay this money back now? Wait a minute, what do we do?
Yeah, I like that, you know, they separate from Britain because they're like, oh, we're not going to pay you for things that you do for us. And then they're like, wait. Oh, fuck.
How about some taxes?
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
It's like, oh, I get it. Now I get it. Now you tell me.
Oh, these taxes were for something all along.
Come on.
The whole time?
The whole time, though? The whole time? Why didn't you tell us? Come on.
So the revenues that our country was bringing in from like import taxes and tariffs were not going to cut it to pay down this debt. So America's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, decided it was time to enact...
Alexander Hamilton!
I knew that was coming.
It is against the law, and I don't want to go to jail. I have to do it.
Yeah.
I'm law-abiding.
So he decided it was time to enact the first ever tax levied by our government on a domestic product. And because everyone was drinking all the goddamn time back then, he was like, hey, let's put a tax on distilling. Isn't that a good idea? Which is pretty fucking ballsy after we just fought an entire war against the British over paying taxes. Hamilton considered liquor a luxury item, but in reality, whiskey was the backbone of the frontier economy at this point in history. And also at this point in history, what was considered the frontier were sort of like the western regions of eastern states like Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, that kind of thing. These were areas that weren't really fully settled yet, mm-hmm. but we had settlements in these areas.
Okay. This is like the Ohio country.
Not even quite to the Ohio country. This is still like in Pennsylvania. 1790.
Okay.
The Ohio territory was still a territory.
It was still a territory, but there were settlements there.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because after the Seven Years' War, that's when the French left that area.
Yeah.
And it all just became British territory.
Okay. Yeah. They couldn't, they could only make people pay taxes if you were in a state that was part of the Union.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Yeah. Yes. They're not official.
Yeah. So we're talking about frontiers of actual states. So these western regions really had like really rough, kind of dangerous dirt roads. They were a lot of times in really rugged sort of mountainous terrain, and it made it really difficult for the settlers out there to get produce to market in eastern cities. So the people living in these regions really felt like they were completely disconnected from the rest of the country. They were sort of on their own. On the frontier. And a lot of times they didn't even really have access to paper money because they were so sort of separate from the rest of the country. So they lived with this sort of quasi bartering economy where there was a little bit of cash coming in, but for the most part, they just traded with their neighbors for 90% of their needs for the year. Because it was so difficult to get their crops to market before they spoiled, most of the farmers in these areas would convert their corn and grains into whiskey, which was in higher demand, kept longer, and could be transported much more easily. So liquor became the main crop in these regions and was often even used as currency. So this whiskey tax may have made sense to legislators in the East, but members of Congress who represented this frontier region knew that putting a tax on whiskey was a terrible fucking idea, and they voted against it. But the law, or this bill, still became law in 1791 and was instantly unpopular almost everywhere in the country. Western settlers and farmers especially saw this as an unfair tax designed to help out the financial class living in cities to the east, and many people even saw this as a direct assault on their livelihood. Now, by modern standards, this tax is really not that big of a deal. But you have to think about the time and the place. These people, first of all, were poor. Mm-hmm. They were extremely poor in a way that we can't even really wrap our heads around today. But also, this is happening at a time when the federal government didn't really do much for people, especially people living on the frontier.
Mm-hmm. There were no libraries.
There were no libraries. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There wasn't...
Terrible times.
If if there were rudimentary dirt roads and bridges and that kind of thing, it was towns and state governments that were funding these things, and like individual communities would fund those kinds of projects. But the federal government wasn't doing that. So these people living on in the frontier were like, what the fuck are we paying you for if we're not getting anything out of it?
The military protecting them, maybe.
Well,
or at least going to them.
There's a lot of, I kind of took this out of my outline because it was like very eye-rolly, but they were saying that they needed protection from the Native American tribes.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But that's not really, they weren't getting the protection they thought they deserved.
Oh,
and so they were like, what's the fucking point? You guys aren't protecting us from the natives. Yeah. We have to protect ourselves. Why should we give you money when we're not getting shit from you?
Preach.
Not only that.
That's how I feel about paying taxes as a Black American. Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah.
What am I? I'm paying for the death of my people?
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool.
So not only that, but there were also some really major problems with this tax law. One of which was the fact that the tax had to be paid in cash. And as I already mentioned, cash was really hard to come by for people living in Western Pennsylvania in this frontier region. Another issue was that anyone who was cited for failure to pay their tax or for failure to register their stills had to appear in a federal court rather than a local one. But the only federal court in Pennsylvania was in Philadelphia, about 300 miles from the frontier settlement of Pittsburgh. Perhaps the biggest problem, though, was the way the actual tax rates were calculated. Distilleries were taxed based on the size of their stills. And thanks to some technicalities in the law, large commercial distilleries were able to take advantage of volume discounts and tax breaks that small rural farmers just could not. So essentially, this meant that the poor were being taxed at a much, much higher rate than rich producers like George Washington himself, who owned one of the largest whiskey distilleries in the country. Surprise.
Yeah, that's like what's happening now.
Imagine that. So many people just straight up refused to pay this tax from the very beginning. They were like, you're welcome to go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
But the government wasn't really feeling that answer. So the bulk of the resistance to this tax came from four of the westernmost counties in western Pennsylvania. And in these areas, they tried, at least at first, they were trying to sort of do the democratic thing and play by the rules. They held a series of public meetings. They drafted petitions asking their representatives to repeal the law. They organized a tax boycott. But it became pretty clear pretty quickly that these peaceful tactics were not working, that this law was not going to be repealed. The tax collectors were going to keep banging on their door. So things turned violent pretty early on. So on September...
Wait. Okay. Violence is not the answer?
Well, the government didn't want the violence. It was the poors were getting violent.
Yeah,
which you can't have that.
Yeah.
So on September 11th, 1791, a tax collector was riding along his route when he was surrounded by 11 men dressed as women. Hey.
I don't like this, but go on.
So they stripped him naked. They tarred and feathered him.
Oh, no.
They stole his horse and they abandoned him in the forest. He recognized two of the men in this group and he ratted them out. And when another guy was sent to issue arrest warrants, this man was also stripped, tarred and feathered, and left in the forest. The tax collector resigned and skipped town.
Yikes.
It's not pretty what these farmers were doing, certainly. Yeah. The next month, a group of masked farmers in another area dragged a tax collector from his bed, marched him 5 miles to a blacksmith shop where they stripped him and burned him with hot irons. So over the next 3 years, dozens of tax collectors were kidnapped, beaten, shot at, whipped, tarred and feathered, branded, or otherwise terrorized, intimidated, and humiliated.
This is such a low-hanging fruit. If you have a problem with the government, you're going to take it out on some peon?
Well, I think the issue was they didn't have access to government otherwise. They were so far and the roads were so poor that they couldn't just like roll up on Philly and be like, hey, stop this. We're not having it. And they did try.
Feels like, very cowardly.
Yeah. I think they just didn't know what to do. And they weren't being listened to. They did try at first. they sent petitions saying, like, we're not going to fucking pay this. You guys are not giving us any support. Why should we give you all this money that we don't have? Some people were even calling for bringing back the guillotine at this point. And by 1794, the government was essentially incapable of collecting the tax from Western Pennsylvania because they were putting up such a fight. They were not letting the tax collectors anywhere near them. But by that summer, things really started to escalate and things really got much, much worse. So July 15th, a wealthy tax collector named John Neville tried to serve a distiller with a summons to appear in court, and he was chased off the man's property. He was not able to deliver the summons. So the next morning, about 50 men surrounded Neville's estate and demanded that he resign and turn over any information he had on local distillers so that he couldn't give it to the government to have them come after them as well. There was a shootout, and one of the farmers, these rebels, was killed. The next day, hundreds more people showed up and surrounded Neville's home. There were some soldiers at a post somewhere nearby. They showed up to kind of try and protect Neville's home. They helped Neville and his family escape, but the house was shot up. Several men were shot throughout the course of the day on either side. Some of them were killed, and Neville's home and his farm were burned to the ground. So after this, local leaders in the area started to worry that GW was going to send in the militia if they didn't strike first. So they were like, we need to take action. We need to do something.
We need to keep escalating as we have been this whole time.
2 weeks later, about 7,000 pissed off locals marched on Pittsburgh, hoping to take the city. They gathered in a nearby field just outside of the town. They listed their grievances and they were kind of like talking about what they should do.
And another thing.
Several people were saying that they should burn down a nearby wealthy neighborhood, but the city was like, oh my God, we need to stop this. What do we do? What do we do? So they decided to send them a peace offering of several barrels of whiskey. And it worked. They calmed these people down. And
they were calmed down with whiskey?
The town was like, please don't burn the town down. Here's some whiskey.
Oh, I feel like, wow. Yeah. Okay,
and it ended with a peaceful march through the town, drunken, but peaceful. Wow. And they went home.
They didn't burn shit.
No.
Oh, okay.
I think they just wanted to be heard. They just wanted somebody to listen to them. And Pittsburgh was, for the most part, their people. You know what I mean? It wasn't the people on high telling them what to do from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I would also like several barrels of whiskey. So I think it's time to take a little break.
Yeah, thank you. I have to take a wee.
Well, hello there. Do you wish your high school history course had more drinking, more swearing, and more ladies?
Well, do we have the show for you. Her Story on the Rocks is a long-form podcast talking about good women, bad women, fictional women, and non-fictional women from all times and places. Basically, each week we pair two women who we research with a themed signature cocktail. You won't be sorry you listened to our latest episode.
Available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cheers!
All right, we're back. Fresh cocktails. So when news of the violence against this tax collector Neville and the march on Pittsburgh reached the national government in Philadelphia, Alexander Hamilton went running to President OGW.
Yes.
And he was calling these farmers insurgents and labeling their resistance to this tax a domestic insurrection. And at first, Washington kind of paused and wanted to use restraint and tolerance, trying to find the best way forward. But Hamilton saw waiting on this issue as weakness. Mm. He saw this as the first domestic challenge to our government's power and authority, and he wrote, "Moderation enough has been shown. 'Tis time to assume a different tone."
Okay.
I think he said our force needed to be like Hercules or something, like Herculean or something.
Yeah.
I wish I had kept that quote in here.
Yeah, he's very, he likes words.
Yes.
The wordsmith. Yeah.
There were a lot of quotes that I ultimately decided to trim just because I'm like, I'm not going
to be. He loved to write.
Yeah. And to that end, he was not just trying to convince George Washington to attack these poor farmers. He was also writing essays to Philadelphia newspapers under a pseudonym.
Yes.
Trying to sway public opinion and build support for military intervention. while he's trying to convince the whole country to attack these poor farmers for a few tax dollars, many people were still sympathetic to the farmers. These are people who had, like you were saying in the last episode a couple weeks ago, people that were sort of forced out of eastern cities and said, like, immigrants weren't welcome. You go out to the frontier.
The rowdy Scots-Irish.
Yeah, you're That's not. Like, we don't want you.
Were they rowdy or were they just not fucking with you?
Yeah, exactly. We don't want you here. Go live out in the middle of nowhere and be poor.
Yeah, go be a body that can be snatched by the natives.
Exactly.
Whose land you're on.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
And we're not even going to protect you.
Yeah.
But we're going to try to extract all this money from you because we're in debt because we went to war. Like, you didn't even care about this war, but here we are.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were really sympathetic to these poor farmers out in the frontier, and they believed in their rights to free speech and assembly and petition. Obviously, yes, they were violent and doing some things that they shouldn't be doing, but they people saw this as sort of like a natural progression of, like, we feel cornered, we don't know what to do, you're not listening to us, so you're going to listen now,
yeah,
sort of thing. Some people even saw this struggle as an extension of the Revolutionary War. Many of these men had just finished fighting the British against unjust taxes and saw their involvement in this as very similar. They had just traded the British kings for a bunch of rich assholes living in the East, living very different lives from their own and not really understanding how they lived or what their lives were like. Mm-hmm. In fact, many of the tactics that they were using to evade this tax were things that they learned during the Revolutionary War, that the army had taught them, George Washington's army. So in August of 1794, Washington sent a delegation of representatives to meet with resistance leaders in Pennsylvania and Virginia, in theory, in an attempt to find a way forward. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually seem like that was really what was going on. The government was not willing to budge. They weren't going to repeal this tax. They weren't going to reduce the tax. They weren't hearing it. They were sort of just there so that they could look like the good guys sending in this, like, delegation to figure things out. These negotiations, quote unquote negotiations, didn't go anywhere. And when the commissioners returned to Philadelphia in September, they told Washington that it was, quote, absolutely necessary that the civil authorities should be aided by a military force in order to secure a due execution of the laws. So the really kind of fucked up thing here is that when you look at the timeline, these meetings were symbolic. There was no intention to work with these people at all. They just wanted to, like, look like the good guys sending a peace negotiation delegation out there when there was no plan to work with them. At least from my perspective, about, you know, in the brief time that I've studied this and looked into this. In August, at the exact same time that these meetings were really just beginning, Washington issued a proclamation accusing the farmers of, quote, inflicting cruel and humiliating punishments upon private citizens for no other cause than that of appearing to be friends of the laws. So, like, you're saying that tax collectors who are out here trying to take the $5 that these people earn in a year are just, they just appear to be friends of the law, and that's all they did. They didn't deserve anything. It's not their fault. This proclamation also called on the rebels to, quote, disperse and retire peaceably to their respective abodes, and also invoked the Militia Act of 1792, which allowed the president to call on state militiamen to put down internal rebellions. And the same day that this proclamation was issued, the very same day, while these meetings had really just started, the Secretary of War sent letters to the governors of Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia asking for help to the tune of about 13,000 militiamen. Shockingly, very few men were willing to volunteer to do this, because nobody believed that this was the right thing to do. So these states had to issue a draft, which sparked...
Wait, there weren't people over there, like, riding for the planter class, we like to call them?
Yeah.
Like they are today? They're out here trying to take bullets for Bezos?
Like, I mean, that would essentially have been what they were doing. The few people that did volunteer.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were like,
But
no.
There's so many now
but
that are
wealthy,
trying to volunteer.
No, exactly. Yeah. They had to issue this draft. left, and a bunch of people were like, fuck that, are you fucking kidding me? So there were protests all over the place in these states. There was widespread draft evasion. But eventually, within about a month, they did gather enough people. They gathered 13,000 men to go after these couple hundred, maybe a couple thousand poor farmers. So within a month, by the time this failed delegation returned to Philadelphia and told Washington to go get them, this militia was ready. They had their 13,000 men. They were gathering in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and
but
preparing to march west.
How committed were these men? Were they like me as an officer?
like I don't want to be here. They told me I had to be here.
I'm just here so I'm not in jail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is a good point.
But it's like whatever starts, it's like, I actually have to pee right now.
Yeah,
I will be right back.
Oh, I have to take a call.
Yeah, I have to call. It's my mother. I haven't talked to her in a few weeks. Uh-huh. Like, she's worried about me. You understand?
Yes. her ficus plant is dying. It's really important.
I will be back when I can.
On September 19th, 1794, George Washington, OG Dub.
Yeah, OG Dub.
He became the only sitting president to ever personally lead troops into the field.
Ever. What?
And he did it against his own people.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. He wore a replica of his old army uniform from the Revolutionary
War. That is
War.
Really, really embarrassing.
Yes. He was 62 years old.
It's like a sailor
old.
Costume for
literally.
An adult.
Yes.
Like, what?
Yeah. He was 62 years old. His original uniform didn't fit anymore, so he had a tailor custom make a copy.
No.
So that he could wear it for old time's sake.
Dude, did you not have a marketing team that told you, like,
this is
you're
not a good
look? Stupid. Like, even the teen, especially the teens, are going to make fun of you.
Yeah, right. Gen Z is out here roasting.
Right, roasting him.
So
all the millennials are like, tell him.
Fucking side part. What are you doing?
Yes.
With your skinny breeches.
He was out here wearing skinny breeches, y'all. Like, come on. Die already.
So this march west through the Allegheny Mountains took about a month. And just about as they were almost there, they're nearly there, OG Dub starts looking around and he's like, maybe I shouldn't actually be here. Maybe this is a bad idea. I don't need to be here. But it was mostly because by the time they got there, there was no more insurrection to put down in the first place. Rumors that this gigantic fucking militia was on its way had made its way west, and everybody just fucking left. They're like, no, ma'am.
Yeah.
We're just a bunch of angry farmers, a couple thousand angry farmers, and you're sending 13,000 armed militiamen to come get us? Goodbye. Most of them went home. Just went back to their farms. Damn. And they're all over the place. It's not even like they're all in Pittsburgh either. They're like out in the middle of nowhere. A few of the men who had been really involved in organizing things and participated in some of the more violent acts throughout this resistance fled west to Ohio territory, where they were sort of like out of jurisdiction essentially and couldn't come after them. So in late October, George Washington just turned around and went back to Philadelphia.
So wait, no one saw his outfit?
The 13,000 militiamen got to see how cool he looked on his horse.
No, but like, you're supposed to show it to the people.
I know. He wanted to crack those skulls so bad, and he got there, and there were no skulls to crack.
Oh, that's... yikes.
Yeah, I know. Poor guy. He went back to Philadelphia, but the whole army couldn't just turn around and go home. They would look stupid. They would be roasted. So instead, Washington was like, hey, Hamilton, why don't you stick around and maintain a presence in Western Pennsylvania to maintain order and hunt down these rebels? So they left these like 13,000 men just like lurking in Western Pennsylvania trying to hunt down the old rebels. So after about a month or so, the army had ended up just going in and like rounding up and arresting hundreds of random townspeople as suspects. They had no warrants and no evidence. It was literally just soldiers showing up in the night, barging into people's homes and taking them away at gunpoint to interrogate them. But most of the people, 90% probably of the people that they were doing this to, were never involved in the first place. It was only farmers who were converting their corn to whiskey who were even a part of this in the first place. So, like, what are
Sounds
you doing?
Sounds like no-knock warrants.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. By mid-November, 150 men had been arrested, but all but 33 of them were released because they had no evidence. None at all. So in 1795, the rest of these men, the 33 who remained, were indicted on an assortment of crimes and were facing prison sentences, but they were eventually let go. George Washington was basically like, these dudes were not the organizers of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So, like, just don't fuck with them. Like, leave them alone. Let them go. Two men, however, were found guilty of treason. Two men who had stayed.
Oh.
There was some evidence against them. They were found guilty of treason and sentenced to hang.
Wow.
But the next year, George Washington decided to give the first ever presidential pardons in American history and released these two men, sent them on their way. A bunch of people were fucking pissed. People in Philadelphia. So a bunch of people in the government were pissed about this. They saw it as a weakness on George Washington's part. And about a month later, he gave his seventh State of the Union address. And in it, he explained his decision that he took his sacred duty to uphold the laws of our country seriously, but he also wanted to apply, quote, every degree of moderation and tenderness that his duty would allow. I mean, after all, these were white men. So they deserved that moderation and tenderness. So that's basically the story of the Whiskey Rebellion. By the time the army showed up, the insurrection was already over and there were no skulls to crack.
Hmm.
He never got the chance. In the end, Washington and his supporters saw this whole thing as a huge rousing success. Hooray! They had proved that the federal government had the power and the strength to shut down a rebellion. And they saw the fact that they did it without any bloodshed as even more successful.
Yeah, like, we're that powerful.
We're just so powerful that the
thought of us.
Yeah, they just
enough.
Ran away. The, you know,
they didn't even need to see my outfit to be afraid.
Yes. Throughout this whole campaign, there were only two deaths and both of them were accidents.
Wow.
There, like, no one was actually killed as a consequence of
what
the
kind
military
of
action.
What rebellion is this?
Yeah. Just Washington's march through the Allegheny Mountains. There were two deaths. So people really saw this as a huge success. And many also believed that Washington's success in this helped to enforce the idea that the newly formed government had the right to pass laws and levy taxes that would impact citizens in all states of the nation. So while the physical opposition to this tax was over, the political opposition was not. Many people within the government saw things very differently from Washington and Hamilton and the Federalists, and from Philadelphia were voicing their fears about unjust taxes, government overreach, and tyranny.
Thomas T.J.? Is T.J.
Yes,
coming in?
Yes, T.J. and James Madison as well, yes. So they were basically saying, like, if the government was going to flex their muscles and shut down resistance to a tax, I wonder what power and rights people have to organize against and resist laws that they find unjust. How much can be done before we ourselves are considered rebels and traitors to the nation? So it kind of seems to me like some of these founding fathers were playing pretty fast and loose with how they wanted to interpret the Constitution before the ink was even dry. Especially when it comes to the First Amendment and our rights to assembly and petition. According to historian Howard Zinn, Hamilton believed that if our country was ever going to be considered a world power, that we needed to keep the wealthy in this country happy. And so he thought that it was better to take advantage of the poor to pay off our debts than it would be to piss off the rich investors who had bankrolled us through the revolution by stiffing them for the bill.
Mm.
Just fuck poor people. Who cares? They don't have any power.
Yeah,
why should we pay attention to
them? What are they
going to
do? They don't have money for an army.
Exactly. And we'll just ride in with the militia and a 20-year-old army uniform that doesn't fit anymore.
I'm just picturing
we'll
it's
show
like
them.
It's like up to his knees.
Many people in the government had a very different way of looking at this from the way Hamilton did. James Madison, for example, was worried that putting down this rebellion would lead to a slippery slope to our country keeping a standing army, which scared the shit out of a lot of the founding fathers because the king had kept a standing army that he liked to use against his own people if he saw fit. And today, we now have a militarized police force from coast to coast that openly wages war against peaceful protesters exercising their constitutional right in
the streets. First Amendment does not apply to brown people.
No, absolutely like, not.
Fuck out of here.
Yeah. This sort of internal conflict that it was brewing within the government because of this, this was not the only reason, but it definitely was a major factor in what led James Madison and old TJ, Thomas Jefferson, to split from the Federalists and form their own party. Washington was firmly against partisan politics, did not want there to be a two-party system. He thought everybody should just get along and work together. But it was too late for that shit. Thomas Jefferson had told Washington that this tax was a bad idea, that it would be seen as, quote, odious.
Ooh.
He called it Hamilton's insurrection. And he said he saw it as, quote, an inexcusable aggression against people at the plows. Jefferson wanted a party that protected individual liberties, and he promised that if he became president, he would repeal the distilling tax. And it worked. In 1800, he defeated John Adams, became president, and the tax was axed in 1802. And we actually existed solely on import taxes and tariffs until the War of 1812. So only 10 years, but that we had a good run for 10 years where there was no tax.
Yeah.
So most modern takes on this, when I was looking this up, most of the articles that I read kind of basically came to the conclusion that this was an important step for our newly formed government to prove that we had the power and the strength to defend ourselves. This was such a good thing that we did, that old OG Dub went in to crack skulls, even though there were no skulls to crack. My take on it is a little different. You know, obviously, we're talking about a bunch of, like, straight white men.
Everyone you've talked about is trash.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
I'm just like, fuck Teach and the horse he rode in on all day, every day. Speaking for the people, fuck off.
Yeah. But this is the very beginning of our history, and we have a group of poor people who's complaining about and organizing against an oppressive tax. And instead of the government, I mean, they sent this delegation to, like, quote unquote, negotiate, but there were no negotiations. They just instantly issued a proclamation saying they were going to war with them. And then the Secretary of War was like, let's do it.
Yeah.
Instead of working with them and trying to figure out the best way forward.
Diplomacy is not our thing.
No, the president.
Violence is our thing.
Yeah. Our first ever president showed up with the army to crack skulls.
I mean, he's done it before.
It set a precedent for how this nation would handle unrest going forward for the rest of our history. This was the very beginning. Yeah.
Always on offense.
So I guess that's the story. I do feel like researching the story really kind of brought up some like current event kind of things in my mind. Obviously, we just had an actual insurrection at the Capitol. And
no, they were just on a tour.
Yes, they were just
on a tour. They were looking for the gift shop.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sure there are people out there in the world that want to compare these two events as like they're just the same. This is just a group of people trying to tell their government how they felt.
They don't care about history.
Yeah. You can't compare these two events. I mean, yes, it is a group of white men who got real violent and did some shit they shouldn't have done. But we're talking about a group of people who showed up to the Capitol with bloodlust in their heart because their president lost an election
they
and they didn't want to.
Constructed gallows plural.
Yeah. Versus like some farmers who were just like forced out into the frontier and said like, I don't want to pay taxes.
Yeah.
To you if you're not even going to protect us. I just see these as very different events.
Yeah, of course.
I also just don't want anyone to look at this as some sort of libertarian dog whistle because it was over taxes. I can imagine coming from where I come from and knowing the people that I grew up with, that people are going to be like, see, taxes are bad. You should just let people. But like, we live in 2021. The government does a lot with our tax money. Yes, they could certainly cut spending, especially on military spending.
But it protects most white people. So it's just like, shut up. And
but
pay
like, they
it.
Also, you know, they're funding schools, sort of. They're maintaining the infrastructure, sort of.
Yeah.
They're
doing a little something.
You know, there's the FDA, there's the internet, there's all these sorts of things that like we can't live without
the
in modern
is privatized.
Society.
Let's not add that one. If only.
Yeah. But like we can't live without these things. And I would be happy to pay more taxes if it meant we would get universal health care, subsidized higher education. But again, these are things that we can't have because we need to force people into the military. We want to keep poor people poor so that they're forced into military service so that they can have nice things.
Yeah, I just shared something on Instagram. Do you remember when Biden, when his son, Beau, was
I saw
sick?
That you shared this, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember that he was thinking about selling his own house to pay for his son's medical treatment? Because he knew that his family would be bankrupted.
This is insane.
Our president was going to sell his home, the home he was living in, the only home that he has, to pay for medical bills. And Obama was going to give him a loan. Like, don't do that.
This is wild.
This is our country.
Yeah. America.
Why?
I know.
This doesn't need to happen.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, like, before you try and use this as some libertarian dog whistle because it's over taxes, you just go fuck yourself. Yeah. It's not the same thing. This is a complicated story. It's hard to figure out who the hero of this story is because
there's just men involved. Yeah. There's no hero.
Yeah.
Go on.
I want to instinctively side with the poor in this story because like the government was fucking shit up and like these people were they didn't want to be out there. Like they couldn't live in the city because
they
don't want you to get out of here.
Emigrated here. No one forced them to come and be on native land.
Yeah.
No one did.
Yeah.
So.
But I don't think they knew when they were emigrating that once they got to the cities that they were going to be like, we don't want you here either.
There are no heroes in this story and that's okay.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I just had a really hard time kind of figuring out like what perspective to like take on what this all meant. But ultimately, like it's the government went to war against poor people because they tried to have a voice.
Yeah. And that's fucked up.
Yeah. The end.
Okay. That was a ride.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. I have so many thoughts and feelings about this. That could be its own podcast. Yeah.
It's not an easy story.
No,
it's not cut
no,
and dry.
Not at all.
It's not, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's few easy stories. Like, not every story is Elvis, okay?
Facts. That's unfortunate, but true.
Are you going to do a mini about...
I'm going to do a mini sort of about alcohol consumption, not really about specifically about this story, but it does sort of start with this story and like some of the other intentions of this tax.
Look forward to it. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my cocktail is... I have like one sip left.
I have an ice cube that is mostly melted at this point.
America's history is juicy. We just add whiskey and water and a little bit of sugar, right?
That's it.
That's it. So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, our podfather. We could not do this without him.
Big facts.
Facts are facts.
That's right, America. Facts are facts.
Bye.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note that we are not historians. We're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember that written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves, and we have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.